If you'd like to listen to tonight's program or any past programs of Truth Quest with Melody, they're available at www.givemesometruth.info or linked from the khen.org website. And I'm Melody, and my co-host tonight is Katie O'Brien. And we have a special returning guest is Kevin Barrett. And before I go any further, though, let me first say the views expressed on this program are those of myself and or my guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the KHEN staff, volunteers, or board of directors. And Kevin Barrett is an outspoken 9/11 truth activist, author and academic, co-editor of the 9/11 of 9/11 and the American Empire, Volume 2, Christians, Jews, Muslims Speak Out, interlinked 2007, and the author of Truth Jihad, My Epic Struggle Against the 9/11 Big Lie, Progressive Press, 2007, and he has taught English, French, Arabic, American Civilization, Humanity, American African Literature, Folklore, and Islam at colleges and university in the San Francisco Bay Area, Paris, Madison, Wisconsin. He's the co-founder of the Muslim Jewish Christian Alliance for 9/11 Truth, or http://mujca.com. His show, like his writings, features Dr. Barrett's all-out struggle for truth, spiced with his offbeat sense of humor. And he's has his radio programs, I believe it's on No Lies Radio, or is that correct, Kevin?
Yes, No Lies Radio, and also on American Freedom Radio on Saturday evenings.
Yes, they've changed their name. I'm trying to get used to the new one.
Yeah, me too. It's hard to keep up with the Patriot Radio world.
Yeah, some of them move around a little bit. Is there anything more you want to add to the your background there?
Well, that was pretty comprehensive, except for one thing, and that's I do have this brand new book out called Questioning the War on Terror, A Primer for Obama Voters. And it was published on July 1st, and we've already almost sold out the whole first printing, so it's going great, and hoping to keep that project going.
Okay, and Katie, say hi.
Hi.
Hey, hi. Katie, how are you?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm doing well.
Well, good. Tell us a bit about your book, Questioning the War on Terror, The Primer for Obama Lovers.
Obama voters, actually. If it had been in the Clinton presidency, it would have been for Clinton lovers, because that's probably 100 million people. So, seriously, I think a lot of people voted for Obama because they, whether consciously or unconsciously, realized that Bush and Cheney's war on terror was a bunch of hooey, and they realized that the military budget had doubled and had gotten into these wars that were just turning into quagmires and, spent trillions of dollars on them and destroyed the economy. So people sort of subconsciously realized that there was a problem with this whole story of 9/11 and the war on terror. And that's why instead of McCain, Mr. War on Terror himself, they voted for Obama, who was the peace candidate, right? The guy who was, against the Iraq war, and he was going to solve all these problems, and his main issue was the economy. So my book is to try to pick up on that. It didn't really work out that way. But my thesis is that if we stand up and demand the change that we voted for, we can get it. And if we don't, we won't.
And how can we do that?
Well, if you read the book and you get to the end, there's a list of 25 specific concrete actions that you can take. And they range from joining a local 9/11 truth group in your community to going out and videotaping lying confrontations with lying politicians like We Are Change does and putting them on the internet and on and on and on, 25 things like that that you can actually do. Basically we need to say no to the direction this country is going, which is towards more war and fascism and economic catastrophe. And so every possible way that we can say no to that, I think, is something that we should be standing up and doing.
So you're saying that you were voted for Obama then?
Well, actually, no, I didn't. I voted for Cynthia McKinney. But a lot of my friends voted for Obama. My wife even voted for Obama. So my experience and family members, almost all my family members voted for Obama. So I have a lot of experience with these kinds of Obama voters, including, I think, sort of average Obama voters, people who know a certain amount of what's going on, have their hearts in the right place. And so that, those are the people I wrote the book for, to reach. Because, you know, in the 9/11 truth community, people are always, you know, preaching to the choir and arguing about little arcane details of what really happened at the Pentagon, or, you know, what really brought down the World Trade Center. And these kinds of things may be fascinating to certain, you know, geeky people, and I'm a little bit geeky. But really, the issue here is we need to inform the wider public. We need to preach to the not-yet-converted people. And the Obama voters are the biggest target demographic here because, like I said, they kind of subconsciously are very suspicious about the war on terror already. So my book takes them through this whole thing step by step, you know, starting with, did you know that you are 30 times more likely to be struck by lightning than to be killed by a terrorist? And moving on to all sorts of other reasons why this so-called war on terror is completely and utterly bogus, no matter what you think happened on 9/11. And once you've demonstrated that, and the reader, you know, virtually every Obama voter that reads this book is going to get that, then you're in a position to go through this history of false flag attacks leading up to 9/11 and realize that, hey, you know, I think these 9/11 truth people might be onto something. And I've test marketed this on lots of these average Obama voters, and it works. You know, almost all of them come around, you know, or moved in the direction of being pro 9/11 truth and realizing just what a hoax the war on terror is.
Now, you had mentioned that there was proof of the London and Madrid bombings that were by U.S. or Western military.
I don't know if I ever said there was proof. I'm convinced that the evidence indicates that, but I don't think it's nearly as overwhelming evidence as in the case of 9/11. But people who are interested in those issues can investigate them by reading, say, Nafis Ahmed's book on the London bombings. And then there's a great film on the Internet called 7-7 Ripple Effect. So Google that up. Watch that. I think that does a very good job of deconstructing the official story of 7-7.
And as far as with what you're saying here, then, I guess I'm kind of not quite sure where you're going with the Obama people. Are they getting disillusioned, or they're just not? Are they getting misdirected? I'm a little lost here.
Well, both. You know,
okay.
I think that they've always been misdirected, because I don't think Obama was really ever the candidate of change that he presented himself as. But on the other hand, he was probably a little bit better than McCain, because who wouldn't be? And Bush and Cheney and so on. But so I think the Obama voters thought they were voting for peace and an end to the war on terror, and they didn't get that. And so now more and more of them are becoming disillusioned. And those people are excellent candidates to read my book and wake up to what's really going on in the world.
But when you say change, are we not getting change? Just a matter of what direction we had perceived.
You know, that's a good point. Yeah, change is constant. You know, you can't step in the same river twice, but it seems like we keep stepping in this sewer of the war on terror over and over and over. So that hasn't changed. I mean, we're still, you know, Obama says that we're in Afghanistan murdering all these people, and saying that these Taliban people who are brave enough to stand up and defend their country against the worst war crime since Hitler invaded Poland, you know, these people are evil terrorists. He's saying this because he claims that the 9/11 attacks came out of a cave in Afghanistan. So, hey, you know, the more things change, the more they stay the same.
Do you think Osama bin Laden is still alive?
Almost certainly not. There's a lot of evidence that he died in probably in December of 2001. And people can find that evidence in David Ray Griffin's book called Osama bin Laden, Dead or Alive.
And the phony bin Laden tapes that have been appearing on the news, how do you think that they're being manufactured?
Well, it's a piece of cake to manufacture fake video these days, especially for people with a lot of resources and expertise at their disposal, such as intelligence agencies. So probably any of the top 30 or 40 intelligence agencies on Earth could very easily be manufacturing these tapes, which are not even very competently done. I'm actually kind of shocked that our tax dollars that are going to the CIA are producing this kind of, you know, low-grade crap that nobody is, you know, with a brain could possibly ever be fooled by. I mean, a lot of these Osama tapes are just ludicrous, you know, like the one where he's got his beard dyed black. I mean, yeah, right. or, you know, a lot of these Osamas in these tapes don't even look like each other. You know, the one in the infamous confession video that was supposedly discovered by some anonymous soldier in a house in, Jalalabad or something in November 2001. You know, in that tape, this guy he weighs at least 50 pounds more than Bin Laden. He writes with the wrong hand. He's wearing gold jewelry. And it's just a complete joke. There's no chain of possession on that video. You know, a top Bin Laden expert, Professor Bruce Lawrence, head of religious studies at Duke University, came right on my radio show and said that tape is bogus. Not only that, he said, but all of his friends in Homeland Security, working on Bin Laden 24/7, 365, know that it's bogus. So, I mean, these Bin Laden tapes are so ridiculous. The one that came out on the eve of the 2004 elections was one of the very worst. You know, that tape actually reelected George Bush. If Bin Laden hadn't come right out there and endorsed John Kerry on the eve of the elections, Bush couldn't have stolen that election because it wouldn't even have been close enough. So we have this long history of ludicrously fake Bin Laden tapes, and people who pretend that he's still alive. I mean, I don't know what planet they're living on.
Well, no, I don't know how people can even think it looks like the same person. I mean, they look distinctively different.
Yeah, I mean, that like, short little guy with the jet-black beard that we saw, like, 2 years ago on the 9/11 anniversary. I mean, come on, that's the same guy as this, like, you know, nearly, you know, 300-pound fat guy in the confession tape. I mean, it's ridiculous. And fundamentalists dyeing their beards. And we had commentators saying, oh, well, he's probably just trying to appeal to the youth demographic. That's not how it works with hardcore Muslim types. You know, it's all just so crazy. It's unbelievable the kind of stuff that passes through the mainstream media these days.
Kevin, would you kind of get in a little bit on how you got to where you're at and how you got started in what you're doing here with the 9/11 movement and your Muslim-Jewish-Christian alliance?
Well, sure. You know, I guess I've always been a little bit skeptical about grand narratives fed to us by the government ever since when, in ninth grade, I went and saw Mark Lane talking about the Kennedy assassination and showing the Zapruder film and then showing that the head snap was reversed when they printed the frames in Life magazine. So Life magazine clearly intentionally misprinted those frames to make it look as if Kennedy was shot from the back when, in fact, he was obviously shot from the front. So from the moment that I saw that in ninth grade, I've been a little suspicious of, you know, what the government tells us. And so after 9/11, being towards the end of a PhD program in Arabic Islamic studies and knowing something about the region, I was kind of suspicious from the get-go, but I didn't really jump into it until 2 years after 9/11, I heard that David Ray Griffin was writing this book, The New Pearl Harbor, marshaling the evidence that the World Trade Center skyscrapers were taken down in controlled demolitions, that it wasn't a passenger jet that hit the Pentagon, no sign of a passenger jet crash in Pennsylvania, and so on. And I said, whoa, that's pretty extreme. I'd better check it out, because David Ray Griffin is a really respectable, sensible academic, you know, 25 academic publications under his belt at that point. I cited him in my PhD dissertation. If somebody like Griffin thinks this, I'd better look at it closely. And I did, and said, holy man, this is outrageous. I mean, this is true. This evidence is very, very strong that all of these things happened, that 9/11 wasn't even remotely what we were told. It was a gigantic scam. And I was so shocked, I said, well, you know, what do I do now? Do I just continue with my career and spend 7 years trying to get tenure at some university, or am I going to stand up and try and defend my country here? And so I chose the latter path, and it's been a real adventure.
I bet. And you may as well go ahead and get into that part, too.
Yeah. Well, I guess I started doing teach-ins at the University of Wisconsin on the big campus mall in spring 2004, and continued through 2005. And in spring 2005, I organized David Ray Griffin's talk at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, which was broadcast nationwide on C-SPAN. And that was kind of the inaugural event for the Muslim-Jewish-Christian Alliance for 9/11 Truth, which I had kind of started at that point along with Dr. Faz Khan. And, that event was very successful, and suddenly all sorts of 9/11 Truth people were sort of all over me insisting that I keep doing this kind of stuff, and there were also some weird stalkers after me for some reason. But I promised my wife to sort of ease off from it a little bit, and I did. And we tried to start a restaurant, and we lost a bunch of money on that, and got even more in debt. And so we've basically been kind of moving forward on this. You know, I've been working on 9/11, and we're scraping by, just trying to keep ourselves and our kids alive over the past several years. And there's been a lot of excitement, including when I got exposed as a 9/11 truth professor by Hannity and Combs and, you know, a bunch of state legislators in Wisconsin who went public and tried to get me fired from the university because I've been doing this 9/11 activism. So that put me all over the news. And so since then, I've been kind of a public figure and doing my best to use that status to advance this 9/11 truth message as much as I can.
And so when you got, so over this period of time, it seems like there's a lot of different activists partner up with various people along the way. Did you partner up with anybody while you were doing this, or have you been pretty much trying to do this on your own, in your own way?
Well, no, I've been working with all sorts of different people in all sorts of different ways. For example, when I was the coordinator at the Muslim Jewish Christian Alliance for 9/11 Truth, we co-sponsored the 2006 Chicago conference, which was the first really big 9/11 conference with over 1,000 people there. That was what kick-started this huge summer of truth that we had in 2006. So I was working with the people from 911truth.org on that particular event, and I've worked with some of those people with other events as well. I ended up sort of passing the Muslim Jewish Christian Alliance off to Lou Stoltzenberg. I'm a Muslim, and Lou is a Methodist, so we thought we should, you know, have equal time for the different faith traditions, and she's taken that over for the last couple of years and run it. And I've been working also with, you know, these people, radio people, you know, have to set up these radio shows at No Lies Radio and American Freedom Radio. And what else? So as far as directly partnering with any one particular person, I really haven't done that.
But you have worked with David Ray Griffin, correct?
Yes. I organized one event for David, mm-hmm. and I've worked with him sort of in the sense of coordinating publicity, getting him on the radio when he has a new book coming out, and I've helped him out with a couple of his research activities, for instance, getting him the transcript and tape of Professor Bruce Lawrence saying that he knows, and all of the CIA Homeland Security types he knows all know, that this so-called Osama confession video was fake. You know, David emailed me and said, you know, where is that tape and transcript? So I, you know, had my friend Ed Reinierson of RadioDuJour.com dig that up for him. In fact, if there's anybody that I would say I've worked most closely with, it probably would have to be Ed. And I really urge people to check out RadioDuJour.com.
Oh, that's right. Okay, that's where he used to send me some of the recordings and things that he did. That's, and I didn't put the two and two together.
Yeah, Ed is recording a lot of what he thinks is sort of the best alternative radio and alternative audio information, and he puts it up at RadioDuJour.com with no commercials, and you know, kind of selects it.
I'll have to go look that up again, because I'm not receiving that anymore. I wonder what happened.
Huh, so. Yeah, well, I'll tell him to put you on his list. I'm sure he will.
So, Katie, you said you had several questions you wanted to...
Yeah, I read that your book, The Truth Jihad, My Epic Struggle Against the 9/11 Big Lie, was the only humorous nonfiction work to come out of the 9/11 truth movement. Could you tell us a bit about that?
Sure. Well, I'm sure that's true. I don't think anybody else has really tried to do anything humorous nonfiction. There have been a couple of humorous fictional pieces, like Hal Sisson's book, Modus Operandi 9/11, which is pretty good. And I think Mike Polachek has used his dark sense of humor to do some 9/11 stuff. But my book is sort of a twisted autobiography in the tradition of Don Quixote, sort of a self-mocking autobiography of how a nice Midwestern white boy turned into a crazed, fanatical Muslim conspiracy theorist.
And that was published by Progressive Press, right? And where
can
you buy this book?
Well, you can find it at Amazon, of course, or you could go to Progressive Press, or you could email me. I still have a couple of copies.
Okay. I find it hard to believe that this had humor in it. Can you give us an example of the humor?
Sure. Well, let's see if I can... boy. Funny, I'm cute.
She put you on the spot there, huh?
Well, yeah. You know, I kept on thinking, well, how could this be funny after reading everything about you and what you've gone through and such? So I'm glad that you could find humor in it.
Yeah, well, just, okay, for example, one, you know, ever-popular item is, you know, people, like, you know, look at me and they kind of do these double takes and like, okay, wait, you're a Muslim? Yes, I'm an Irish Muslim. You know, we're the most dangerous kind. Watch out for us. You know, we might float a big Goodyear blimp full of Guinness into the Tower of London and take it down that way, you know. And then so I wrote this sort of folkloric ditty about being an Irish Muslim. It's something I sing to my kids to help them understand their glorious Islamic Hibernian heritage. It goes like this. I was born in County Kerry with the Guinness in me hand. That thick white foam washed o'er me like the waves wash o'er the sand. One great black wave broke on me brain and washed me sense away. And I became a Muslim on that glorious drunken day. Hey! But now, me drinking days are done. Alhamdulillah, praise God. Me drinking days are done. Inshallah, if God wills. Raise your glass to this Irish Muslim whose drinking days are done. And it kind of goes on from there, but that's enough for tonight.
Well, that was wonderful. That gives me insight into it, at least. And when did you become Muslim?
That would have been 93, I believe. Or is it 92, 93? Yeah, early 93.
And what inspired you to become Muslim?
A whole bunch of things. The works of Ibn al-Arabi, the greatest theosophist of all time.
He's a theosophist? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, he's considered a sort of a whacked out Sufi, what would you call him? I guess theosophist, yeah, what else could you call him? He's a poet and wrote an amazing, gigantic spiritual autobiography, only a small part of which has been translated from Arabic, but what's there is enough to make you realize that this is a pretty interesting character.
And as far as looking at your background here and what you teach, I mean, you really have taught a lot of different subjects. And did you go live among the Muslims at all? Or?
Well, I kind of live among the Muslims now. Like, my family's Muslim, and I live here in the Madison, Wisconsin area. And there is a pretty good-sized Muslim community here, well over 1,000 people. But I did also spend a year in Morocco in 1999-2000. I've been in Morocco several times, but that was the time I stayed for a year, and I like it there.
And can you tell us a bit about what happened while you were in Morocco? I understand that you went there to apprehend an accused 9/11 hijacker.
Well, that wasn't the time I spent a whole year there. You know, if I spent a whole year there, I probably would have found the guy. But I was just there for a month that time. And actually, that was kind of a publicity stunt designed more to bring attention to the fact that there had been 10 of these alleged 19 hijackers who turned up alive after 9/11, including this guy Walid Ashari, who walked into the U.S. Embassy in Rabat and said, yeah, this is my picture. This Ashari guy that was supposedly another hijacker is my brother. I did train at these air schools in Florida where they said I did, but I didn't have anything to do with 9/11. And I guess they believed him. He left, and since then nobody's heard hide nor hair of him. So, and that was, of course, right after 9/11. So I went over there in, I think it was 2007. I announced to the press that I'd become a bounty hunter since the university wouldn't hire me that semester. And I sort of dangled a pair of handcuffs at them and a bounty hunter's badge. and said I was going over to bring Waleed Ashari back, dead or alive. You know, I said, Waleed, you know, you, I don't know how you got out of that 767 that you were piloting before it hit the tower, but that was the last miraculous escape you'll ever make. I'm bringing you back here in handcuffs to face justice, and so on. And in the press, you know, found that amusing enough, and they could play it as kind of a, you know, goofy conspiracy theorist thing enough that they actually published it and got a lot of mainstream coverage. And then, you know, linked some of the people would then Google and find out, oh, yeah, this Waleed Ashari guy, you know, the BBC says he was still alive after 9/11. So anyway, I went over there, and I did try to find out information about him. And what I discovered was, the interesting thing was that he probably was not really a pilot with Royal Air Maroc, which is what the BBC had said. And their story was actually based on this Saudi paper out of London. But in fact, he was probably a pilot for the Saudi airline. And I did talk to a higher-up at the Saudi airline who let it be known that, yes, there was something to the story, but he didn't really want to talk about the details. And, you know, we just want peace. We don't want to get into these things.
Well, I've heard since 9/11 that many of the alleged hijackers are still alive. Why do you think this hasn't been broadcast more widely?
Well, there's been a huge cover-up, and these guys were playing a role. They were being very well paid. You know, they were running around with, like, wads of $100 bills and all the cocaine they and all their friends could use, and, you know, free trips to Vegas and lap dancers and prostitutes and so on and so forth. So they were living really well. They were getting paid by probably some group that's right on the borderline between intelligence agencies and drug smugglers. And they may have actually been running some drugs, for all we know. You know, the airstrip where Muhammad Atta was pretending to learn to fly prior to 9/11 was actually, it was where the biggest heroin bust in Florida, or Central Florida, history ever happened. And it happened right when Atta was there. And they gave back the plane to the guy who owned the airstrip, a guy named Wally Hilliard, a CIA drug mafia guy from Green Bay, Wisconsin, actually. So these guys were probably Saudi, eight guys were brought over. They were all brought over here to the U.S. on CIA snitch visas. When the CIA employs Saudi agents, it rewards them both with money and then with a free trip to the U.S. on a special kind of visa after they're done, you know, doing their dirty work in Saudi Arabia. So all of these Saudis, and I think the Saudis were like, what, 17 out of 19 or something, those guys were all brought over to the U.S. on CIA snitch visas. And I have that from a good friend of mine whose brother-in-law is in the CIA and told him that. So in any case, so these guys are intelligence assets. They're brought over here. They get involved, heavily involved in drugs, probably drug smuggling. They're probably being paid to mule drugs around a little bit. And so they're not just like innocent people who were just picked out from nowhere to be the patsies. They were set up very carefully to be the patsies as part of their criminal intelligence operations. And thus, probably these 10 guys popped up after 9/11 to sort of wave and say, hey, we didn't do it, you know. And what happened to them then? Well, maybe they were killed. Maybe they were taken back to Saudi Arabia. Apparently, there's been a kind of an understanding with Saudi Arabia post 9/11. You know, 9/11 was partly about keeping Saudi Arabia in the U.S. orbit. You know, just in August 2001, the King of Saudi Arabia said, it's time for a parting of the ways. You know, Saudi Arabia is going to leave the U.S. empire at the end to this oil for money arrangement that's been going on since Nixon and Kissinger. And 9/11 was partly designed to prevent that and to give Bush the chance to say, okay, leaving our empire, we're get ready to see, you know, we're going to nuke Mecca and Riyadh, which is pretty much what Bush also said to Pakistan. So 9/11 gave them the excuse to crack down on those forces in Saudi Arabia that wanted to leave the U.S. empire. And, of course, there are other corrupt forces in Saudi Arabia are basically run by the U.S., well, I should say by the New World Order, and those forces would have been involved with setting up these patsies. And these patsies might have just gone back to Saudi Arabia and then told, okay, that's it, you know, stay out of the limelight from now on or else. Or maybe they were killed, but who knows.
So they really haven't turned up much since then, in other
words? No, they all sort of showed up right after 9/11, waved to the cameras and said, hello, here we are, and then boom, they disappeared.
Now, I did do an interview with Chris Emery, who had mentioned that Atta had kind of shown up around the Oklahoma City bombing. Are you familiar with that?
Yeah. I've talked to Chris. I've had Chris on my radio show, and that's very interesting. Supposedly, not only did a bunch of these alleged hijackers show up in Oklahoma City acting very suspiciously before 9/11, but also some of them showed up in Oklahoma City after 9/11 as well.
And what were they doing there after 9/11? Hiding?
No, they were drinking in a bar.
Oh. They were drinking there. Okay.
Yeah. I think it was the same bar. You'd have to ask Chris for the details. As I recall, Atta, when he was there partying and drinking, that's pretty much all these guys ever did. When Atta was in Oklahoma City partying in this bar prior to 9/11, he actually charged his drinks on a U.S. government credit card. That's what the bartender said.
I was under the impression that Muslims did not drink alcohol.
Well, I was too. that's why even people who don't buy the so-called conspiracy theories about 9/11 have to admit that this was a complete false flag attack, that Muslims have been blamed for this, and yet these 19 guys that did it were the furthest thing imaginable from Muslims. They weren't remotely close to being even nominal Muslims, much less practicing Muslims. These guys were drinking all the time. Atta's favorite food was pork chops, and according to his girlfriend Amanda Keller. And also Atta, this is interesting, he spoke a whole bunch of languages fluently, including fluent Hebrew. Now, where did this Egyptian Muhammad Atta ever pick up fluent Hebrew? His biography gives us no place where that could have happened. So, there's probably a double, and several of these guys, well, Ziad Jarrah, for example, the Lebanese Mossad guy, clearly had at least one double and possibly two doubles. So, the intelligence operations, they do this. They double people. They make fake identities. They find, people who resemble each other, and one of them is a, insider agent, and the other one is the patsy, and so on. And they probably ran a lot of these guys that way.
So that just to add more confusion to the whole situation. And at the same time, they're trying to bring them out to make sure that everybody sees them to confuse the issues of what was brought up as it to have supposedly happened then, correct?
Yeah. Typically what they do in these situations is they'll take whoever's going to be the patsy and they'll kind of overplant evidence and, really set them up and make them, conspicuous. So right after the event happens, suddenly this really conspicuous, ridiculously over-conspicuous evidence points towards the patsy. And everybody at that point is still, their minds haven't been made up yet. They're in that state where they, still are open to suggestion. And so the first impression after an event like 9/11 or the JFK assassination is the one that sticks. So in this case, they did things like planting Muhammad Atta's cars at two different airports. They claim that Atta left a car at Boston's Logan Airport, and Atta also left a car at the Portland Maine Airport. And now how he did this is a real mystery. And that's just one example of this ridiculous overplanting of, obviously fake evidence. Another example is his suitcase. Atta supposedly checked on his suitcase on board this plane that was going to be, transferred onto the suicide plane. And in that suitcase, he had his last will and testament. In fact, it was a ridiculous parody of a Muslim's last will and testament. It was produced by somebody who didn't know very much about how to do this. Why would Muhammad Atta put his last will and testament in a suitcase that he was going to check onto a suicide plane? And then why was that suitcase the only one of hundreds that didn't make the transfer from the plane from Portland, Maine to Boston to the plane from Boston to allegedly the North Tower? So they overplant this evidence. They make up ridiculously phony evidence that anybody can see as phony, such as Atta's insane last will and testament that starts out, "In the name of God, myself, and my family," which is a bad screw-up of what Muslims really begin things with, which is, "In the name of God, the merciful, the compassionate." And that's just the beginning of why every Muslim who looks at this supposed last will and testament of Atta just, rolls their eyeballs and can't believe that any competent intelligence agency would be so crazy as to try to say that something like this is a real document. But it's the incompetence. That's what really shocks me, I think, more than anything else, is how badly these people pulled off 9/11.
Well, the part that really should, the part with the Muslims, it's got to be really frustrating and with them to realize that they're being set up in so many situations, and they're not the only ones that get set up. It's kind of like the FBI or whoever the agency that seems to be involved in some of these events. The FBI has been kind of a dominant one in some of these ones that have taken place inside the U.S., that, you know, they have two or three groups they like to target and always blame for whatever these events that take place, anywhere from the Oklahoma City bombing to, you know, 9/11. And it's got to be, I mean, I'd be not real comfortable being Muslim just because of the fact that they're always setting them up.
Yeah, that's true. Muslims have kind of become the enemy du jour, and a lot of Muslims have reacted to this situation by kind of crawling into their shells and sort of pretending it's not happening and feeling, a lot of people feel powerless. But, you know, I'm trying to motivate Muslims to stand up and fight back against these things, you know, and so, but it's so hard, though, to convince people that it's worth exposing themselves to the kind of persecution they think they can get if they speak out.
Well, you don't see the ADL standing up for them like they do for other groups that seem they love to jump on and say that, you know, this is either racist or anti-Semitic or whatever.
Well, when I first started the Muslim Jewish Christian Alliance for 9/11 Truth, I was sort of under this illusion that Jewish people would understand suffering and understand how it feels to be singled out and tormented and persecuted and faced with genocide. Because, after all, you know, we've seen a million people murdered in Iraq alone just because they were Muslims and because Americans were brainwashed into thinking Muslims did 9/11. So I figured, well, you know, in the Jewish tradition would really foster a certain kind of compassion for that situation, and I would expect, you know, Jewish people to be disproportionately motivated to join the 9/11 Truth Movement and to sympathize with these Muslims who've been set up and subjected to torture and persecution and, you know, incarceration and concentration camps and sex torture camps and genocide. Well, I've been really disillusioned. It seems, you know, if anything, Jewish people are disproportionately involved in the 9/11 cover-up. It's been so frustrating to try to reach out to Jewish people in this country. And, there, you know, there are a few of good folks like, you know, Steve Alton, the author of The Shell Game, Rabbi Michael Lerner published a very good essay in my book, 9/11 American Empire, Volume 2, Christians, Jews, and Muslims Speak Out. But overall, it's been a really frustrating experience. And you start to notice after a while that these people that are blocking 9/11 Truth, like Amy Goodman, you know, the editor of The
Progressive. You've noticed that, too?
Yeah, Matt Rothschild of The Progressive. Norman Solomon, the big media guy. I just wrote about this on my blog a few weeks ago. There's this really disproportionate, Noam Chomsky, you know, disproportionately in the alternative media, you notice all these Jewish names are the biggest roadblocks to 9/11 Truth.
And
then you start looking at who runs the mainstream media, and there are very good estimates by people who've actually, you know, who have a lot of experience in the mainstream media, that probably about, you know, 50% plus of the key positions in the mainstream media are occupied by Jews, and virtually all of them are pro-Israel. So, having tried to reach out to the Jewish community on this, and I feel utterly rebuffed, it's really made me, you know, feel very disillusioned.
What does pro-Israel have to do with realizing that 9/11 was not necessarily the event that had been purported to be?
Well, you know, I think the problem here is that a lot of folks, including a lot of Jewish people, worry and suspect that Israel and the Mossad and its helpers in the U.S. may have either been involved in this or possibly may have been the main force behind it. And that's a scary thought to Jewish people because they do have this history of persecution. And for all they know, if this truth came out, there would be pogroms in the USA. I think that's the problem. And, you know, Sandra Lubarsky, who was my Jewish co-editor in 9/11 and the American Empire, Volume 2, and she wrote a very moving essay about this, about her feelings, her fear that Israel might be involved in this, how she felt about that as an American Jew. And, of course, how she felt was she was terrified. And I think that terror, whether conscious or unconscious, is probably the biggest reason why this long list of key Jewish people in both the alternative and mainstream medias, I think, are a huge force against 9/11 truth. And that's just the way it is. I hate to say it, but it's the truth.
Well, to clear up a few things in regard to being a Muslim, basically, is Ishmael the son of Hagar the beginning of the Muslim religion?
Oh, no. The beginning of the Muslim religion is, well, the beginning of time. Everything is Muslim because everything submits to God. Humans and certain other conscious entities are the only things that have the choice of trying to not submit to God. And if they do that, then they screw up. So basically everything has always been Muslim. Everybody's always been Muslim. Every child is born Muslim until it gets misled into being something else. So that's the basic, you know, cosmology. In terms of the history, Muslims traced themselves back to Adam, the first prophet. The first human was the first prophet, and Abraham, who is also in this line of prophets. And Muslims accept the same group of prophets as Jews and Christians. You know, Moses, Muhammad, Jesus, the whole line of biblical prophets, and a few others thrown in for good measure. Does that help?
It's still a little confusing in regard to. I understand where Christianity came along in regard to Christ.
Mm-hmm.
In regard to them actually using the word Muslim,
mm-hmm.
does that all go all the way back to Adam, or is that something that came later?
Well, I believe the word, it's, you know, the word Muslim actually was not the only word that was used to describe somebody of the Muslim faith, as we call it now. The word mu'min, which means kind of believer or knower of sacred reality, was equally prominent. But yes, the word Muslim is used in the Quran, which was revealed to Prophet Muhammad, peace upon him, beginning in about 610 A.D. and continuing through his death in 632 A.D. And so that would be the time that this concept of Islam, meaning submission to God, took on that, you know, the language, the verbal tradition that we think of when we think of the religion of Islam. But the teaching is that Jesus was a Muslim too, meaning that Jesus was teaching the same type of submission to God that Muhammad taught. And so were all the other prophets, Moses and Solomon and David and Adam and the whole lot of them, Abraham, of course. So that's the idea, is that Islam comes and sort of clarifies what it really was that all these other religious figures in this particular tradition and other figures outside the tradition were really teaching, the
and
quintessence of religion.
With the amount of Jewish people in denial in regard to the 9/11 truth and kind of blaming it on Muslims, how were you ever able to coordinate the Muslim-Jewish-Christian alliance?
Well, what I did then was just try to reach out as much as I could, and I tried to, you know, I would email all these people and invite them to look at this evidence and so on. And when I worked on the book, we had Sandra Lubarsky there to try to bring in some Jewish contributors. And one of the first really frustrating things about that situation was that, you know, I'm the Muslim editor, and John Cobb, one of the world's most famous Christian theologians, was the Christian editor. And both of us brought in, you know, a bunch of people from our traditions who were, you know, very strongly pro 9/11 truth. Mm-hmm. And then Sandra, the Jewish editor, said, "Well, I don't think I can find enough. I can't find five Jews who were in favor of 9/11 truth. So we need to have this book include people who are not in favor of 9/11 truth." And you know, I said, "Really?" But okay, Sandra, whatever, you know, well, if that's the way it is, then we'll have to do it that way. So we actually, a couple of the Jewish contributors, in fact, I think maybe three out of five or six, you know, almost about half are really not in pro 9/11 truth. You know, I just kept trying. Keep trying. And when something, you know, when something good happens, you celebrate it. But lately I've been, you know, honest enough to say, you know, I've been slogging away at this for years now, and I'm just going to come out and tell the truth, which is that Jewish control of media, finance, and organized crime is a huge part of the problem.
So, but what about, but a lot of Jewish people are not involved with those aspects. I mean, that
well,
is
of course
that,
not. The vast majority are not.
Yeah, so essentially, you're saying that even now you're not, there's Jewish people that aren't coming forward and saying that, questioning that event?
I'm not saying there aren't any.
I didn't say that either, but what I'm saying, you're not finding more by this point in time. It hasn't kind of bled under that
group. I mean, we're not finding enough Christian and Muslim people willing to step forward either. So let's be fair about this.
Okay.
And also, it's important to point out that the majority of Jewish people in the USA and elsewhere have no more guilt in any of this than anybody else.
Right.
In fact, you know, of all ethnicities in the U.S., Jews were the most against the war in Iraq. So there's a real disconnect between organized American Jewry in the form of AIPAC and this Israeli lobby, which is pretty much the group that would tie together these billionaires and media moguls and organized crime figures like Larry Silverstein, you know, the World Trade Center demolisher who made billions and billions of dollars profit on blowing up those buildings with mm-hmm. people inside them. You know, those kind of people, sort of powerful, wealthy, powerful, and generally very corrupt people who happen to have a Jewish ethnicity, and some people would call this like the Jewish mafia. Those are the people that are the problem, and this vast majority, 99% of the Jewish people in the U.S. are not the problem at all, except to the extent that they've been brainwashed by these really nasty, powerful Zionists.
So, but then now you brought in the term Zionist, of course, which doesn't necessarily mean tied to being Jewish, does it?
Of course not. No, the real Jews are the Naturei Karta people who are strongly opposed to Zionism. They recognize that Zionism is basically an organized crime operation that stole Palestine from the rightful residents, the people who lived there, and has been hideously tormenting them and creating all sorts of turmoil and unrest and misery in the world ever since. But the problem is that since World War II, before World War II, most Jews in the U.S. and most rabbis, in fact, were not Zionists. They were anti-Zionists. They didn't think there should be a Jewish state in Palestine. Then the Holocaust happened, and I think a lot of these Jewish people just lost faith in God. And then they said, well, we've got to defend ourselves. We have to be really tough and mean and nastier than the Nazis. And so they, you know, created this vicious little settler colony, stolen Palestine, and have been running it with an iron fist ever since and grabbing more and more power here in the USA.
When did the group of Palestinians actually lose the land that they were on? Was that during the 40s?
Well, actually, Palestinians owned roughly 90% of the land in what is now Israel-Palestine. Until the United Nations, which was pressured by President Truman, who at that point, you know, the U.S. had all the power in the world and could tell the U.N. to do anything it wanted at that point because we came out of World War II basically owning the world. So Truman was given, as the story goes, $1 million in cash in a suitcase by a Jewish friend of his from the pro-Zionist community. And Truman then went ahead and had the United Nations approve a plan that stole the land that was at that time 90% Palestinian-owned and 10% Jewish-owned. And it divided up that land in such a way as to give about two-thirds of it to the Jews and only about one-third of it to the Palestinians. Now, this was so grotesquely immoral and wrong that all decent people in the world rose up against it, including the people of the Middle East who pressured their governments to go to war against this Zionist entity that had been created by $1 million handed to Harry Truman. And that was the first war.
Why did I think that it was the British that kind of set that whole scenario up back in World War One?
Well, the British stole Palestine originally from the Turks. The Ottoman Empire, as an Islamic caliphate, was considered a relatively legitimate government by most people in that region. Then the British came and stole it after World War One and gave it slowly but surely to the Zionists. So the British definitely bear a lot of the responsibility for this.
I mean, wasn't that with the intent of making it a Jewish state down the road?
No, not supposedly. No? What happened apparently was there was this Balfour Declaration that came right after World War One, which gave said Palestine should include a Jewish homeland. But it didn't say anything about a Jewish state, much less about any ethnic cleansing of Palestinians. Mm-hmm. That didn't happen until 1948, and that was after the Israeli terrorists had driven the British out.
Okay. I know we got a little bit off of your forte here, and as far as your 9/11 and your programming, as far as your radio program. And I mean, you do a lot of interviews with people around that movement, correct?
Yeah, I would say, you know, that it probably somewhere more than half of my guests on my Tuesday show are 9/11 truth people. And that's the main topic, and perhaps somewhat less than half, maybe a quarter of the guests on my Saturday show are. So, yeah, I'm still pushing it.
One of the things I was wanting to kind of get into, because that was what I really found quite, I mean, you interviewed a lot of people, and some of them are some really interesting people. In fact, one of them that I hadn't really heard the story of was a little bit of Chris Boleyn, and I think I've got his name correctly. In fact, I hadn't seen him around a lot in the alternative media lately. And do you have anything you'd like to add about that interview or any of your other interviews that have been significant in helping you with this, getting your message out of why you feel 9/11 is so important?
Yeah, sure. Are we on the air now?
We should be.
Oh, okay. Great, yeah. We were just talking about doing station IDs and stuff. Yeah, Chris Boleyn was a very exciting interview. I'd wanted to interview him for a long time. I remember when, I think it was back in around 2006, or possibly even 2005, he was arrested by Chicago police, kind of sitting in his yard, minding his own business. These police just came along and came into his yard and tasered him and beat him up and arrested him for supposedly assaulting them, I guess. And he was pretty well persecuted by the Chicago police. He saw the writing on the wall that this was all coming down from on high, Chicago being the corrupt town that it is. And he got out of Dodge and headed for Europe. And he's been in exile ever since. And people haven't heard too much from him. He did a lot of the early investigative journalism on 9/11. And a lot of it did point in the direction of Israeli involvement. And so then he disappeared from the radar screen for a while, and I tried to get him on the show a couple of times. And finally this, just when was it, a few weeks ago, not very long ago, he said he could. So I just interviewed him over at nolizeradio.org, and people can go there and find the archive. And I think people really should read Chris's book. His book is called 9/11 Solved. It's at boleyn.com, boleyn.com, and you can download it free. He's given it away. It's huge, and it's full of interesting information. He is, I think, very strongly focused on the Israeli and Zionist connection to 9/11, which I think is a very important topic, but it's not the only one. I think there's also all kinds of other evidence that points in not necessarily that same direction. But I do think that his work is very noteworthy, and people should, you know, should check it out and see what they think.
And what is one of the biggest Zionist lies in regard to Palestine?
Well, you know, what isn't? I mean, the whole story that we hear in the mainstream media about that conflict is one big Zionist lie. And basically, they say they're the victims. Well, psychopaths are well known for this trick of, you know, the pity ploy is what it's called. They try to get pity by playing the victim when it's all a calculated sort of ruse and they're crying crocodile tears. And that's what they've been doing forever there. Of course, what's, you know, the reality of the situation is that they, you know, invaded and occupied and ethnic cleansed Palestine and have been brutally persecuting the indigenous Palestinian population the whole time. And it's just gotten worse and worse and worse. Currently, one obvious and huge Zionist lie is this claim that an Iranian nuclear weapon would be a disaster, whereas Israel has 400 nuclear weapons. And, you know, Iran hasn't attacked any other country for centuries. And if there's one country that would probably be a very safe country to have a nuclear weapon, it would be Iran. You know, the U.S. has actually used these things on cities and murdered hundreds of thousands of people with them. Israel is the most insane country, I'm the face of the planet. It's, you know, Idi Amin basically, you know, took over that role for a couple of years, but Israel's had it the rest of the time. And so Israel is telling the U.S. that we have to attack Iran because Iran, which is a signatory to the international nuclear treaty, is for some reason dangerous, whereas Israel, which is a non-signatory that has illegally developed 400 or so nuclear weapons, is okay. I mean, is not a threat. It's so absurd, I just can't believe that the U.S. mainstream media is able to convince Americans that this is the case. And that, why, you know, Americans should look at this situation and say, wait a minute, the media is telling us that Iran is a threat. Why are they telling us this? Who's Iran really a threat to? You know, and of course, they're a threat to Israel because Ahmadinejad tells the truth, and the Iranian Arabic TV tells the truth to the Arab world about what's going on in Palestine. And so they're a threat because they're telling the truth and they're supporting justice. And that's why Israel would like the USA to do its dirty work for it and nuke them. So it's a crazy, horrific situation. And Obama, who unfortunately I think is largely a creature of the same, you know, finance mafia. His top three contributors, I understand, are all big-time wealthy Jewish Zionists from Chicago. And, he, you know, this is the community that gave him his start in politics. I don't trust him to stand up to these insane forces that would start World War III by launching a war on Iran.
Well, Rahm Emanuel has kind of a pass there anyways, doesn't he?
He's a Mossad agent. I mean, why does the President of the United States have a right-hand man who's a Mossad agent? It's crazy. And it's, you know, he worked for IDF. He was in the IDF. He fought for a foreign military or worked with a foreign military and came back as an agent of a foreign power, and now he's running the president. It's absurd. I mean, the guy should be on trial for treason.
How do you think it was possible for our general news to hide the issue that the United States has so many nuclear bombs and we're the only ones that have used them, but to be afraid of this small country over here who has limited access?
Well, I guess there's just, you know, no way to exaggerate the stupidity of a lot of people, or ignorance, I should say, because they're not stupid when their own interests are at stake. You know, if they're betting on a football game, they can be very smart at figuring out who's likely to win. But, you know, when it's something like some nation versus some other nation, they're likely to just cheer for our nation, just like, you know, they might cheer for their football team. And it's easy to play off those kinds of emotional sets by, you know, feeding people deceptive imagery and you know, psychological manipulation. And you know, that's, I guess, but again, it's just so ridiculous. It's hard to believe that more people haven't awakened to this.
Because it's definitely droned on the news regularly. Oh, no, Iran's going to have a nuclear bomb, you know. And we have so many, and it's like the ones that the United States put out there really aren't talked about.
Indeed. You know, the U.S. has been the leader in the nuclear arms race from the get-go, after nuking Hiroshima and then Nagasaki. And, you know, even the people who try to defend this hideous criminal attack on Hiroshima would have to admit that, why Nagasaki? You know, that's, and of course the reason for that was to scare the Russians. And that's what these bombs were really all about. You know, the Japanese were ready to surrender anyway, and they would have surrendered on face-saving terms anyway. So the only purpose in murdering these, 150,000-plus human beings in these two Japanese cities was to frighten the Russians into being more submissive in dividing up Europe. So that's a heck of a reason to murder that many people. So the country that did that, the USA, is now being ordered by an even crazier and more murderous country, Israel, to go and kill a bunch of Iranians because, well, this Iran, which is, the CIA tells us, is not working on any nuclear weapons, is legally developing nuclear power capability as a lawful signatory to the nuclear treaty. And it's completely bizarre. And the way they spun this latest revelation, you know, Iran reports to the International Nuclear Agency that they have a new, here's this nuclear facility, we're reporting it as we're supposed to under the treaty, and the U.S. media all says, oh, they have a previously secret facility, quick, attack them.
And how did the United States come under such influence by Israel?
Well, there's a book called Foreign Agents by Grant Smith. that covers this historically. And, you know, briefly, I guess, after World War II, there was a group, I think, was it called the Zionist Agency, I think it was called, that was operating lawfully as a registered agents of a foreign power. And as they got bigger and bigger and bigger, they decided it would be a lot easier if they didn't have to register, because if you register as an agent for a foreign power, you have to fill out all kinds of forms and basically disclose all of your funding and all of your activities. So you have to be transparent. But if you're just a domestic political lobby, you don't. So they deregistered. They created a new name for themselves, AIPAC, the American Israeli Public Affairs Committee, and they continue to operate as unregistered agents of a foreign power, which means that they're all criminals. They all should be arrested as unregistered agents for a foreign power, because if you're an agent of a foreign power, you have to register. So these people have been walking around committing this crime openly since about 1960. So what's that now? 50 years, half a century of open criminal activity by the Israeli lobby. And it's gotten bigger and bigger the whole time. You know, there are those who tell us that they had something to do with killing JFK. It wasn't just the Israeli lobby, of course, but JFK was hell-bent on shutting down the Israeli nuclear program before it got started. And Ben-Gurion, who was then head of Israel, felt that that was an existential threat to Israel. So it was very convenient that Kennedy got taken out and replaced by Johnson, who was a complete Israeli stooge. He had a blonde Mossad bombshell sexually servicing him with the permission of this bombshell's husband the whole time he was in office. And you know, Johnson was, he was basically, he might as well have been a Mossad agent. In fact, you know, he arranged the 67 war along with the leadership of Israel, and he was all set to sacrifice the Liberty, the USS Liberty, which was sunk by the Israelis, 34 deaths and hundreds of people wounded. And Johnson wanted that ship to go to the bottom. He said, I want that goddamn ship on the bottom. And why? Well, because he'd set this up with Israel. He set up the war, and then the idea was to bring the U.S. into the war by blaming this attack on Egypt. So, but the problem was that the Liberty sailors wouldn't go to the bottom. They fought back heroically and got a message out, and they had to call off the attack and admit that it was the Israelis. Johnson didn't get to invade the Middle East and attack the Russian bases in Egypt as he wanted to distract attention from Vietnam. So anyway, there's this long history where the Israeli lobby moves in, possibly is probably involved with killing Kennedy. You know, Jack Rubenstein, a.k.a. Jack Ruby, was a Jewish mafia hitman from Chicago, and he took out Oswald. And, you know, there are some other folks like that involved. Meyer Lansky, who's the capo, the top mobster in the world at that time, was heavily involved in that plot, and on and on. So this lobby has just been getting stronger and stronger. Its tentacles are intertwined with the top financial circles and with organized crime. And so when you see, you know, a Jewish mobster like Larry Silverstein buying the World Trade Center 3 weeks before it's taken down, a decision which would have made no sense if it wasn't going to be taken down, and then he doubles its insurance, and then he, after these demolitions, he goes on national television and says that they decided to pull Building 7. He confesses to that, and then he still walks off with $3.5 billion in insurance money. Actually, no, I'm sorry, $4.5 billion off at the get-go, and he's back in court asking for $11 billion more now.
He's doing that now.
Yeah, he wants another $11 billion from the insurance companies that covered the airlines.
Really?
Why would Israel need 400 nuclear bombs?
Well, if they're an expansionist country. They won't even define what their borders are, because ultimately they, at least a lot of them, think that they own, God has promised them, everything between the Nile and the Euphrates. So that means they have to steal, you know, Egypt, a bunch of Egypt. They have to steal a lot of Mesopotamia. They have to steal most of, you know, a lot of what the whole heartland of the Middle East. And to keep expanding and doing this and ethnic cleansing the people who live there now, they have to be on a permanent war footing pretty much against the whole world.
And aren't they really considered one of the best air forces in the world?
Yeah, I think they're number four. They're the fourth most powerful military in the world.
So where does the United States sit in regard to that?
Well, the United States spends more money on its military than all of the other significant military powers on Earth combined. And this is why we're going broke. And it isn't just the fault of the Zionists that this is going on, but it's partly their fault, largely their fault, because you have this unholy alliance between the arms manufacturers and the Zionists. The Zionists, who are so emotionally attached to Israel, know that unless the U.S. becomes a really militarily powerful juggernaut of an empire and stays that way, Israel is doomed. So they are the strongest force pushing for, you know, bigger military budgets and so on. These neoconservatives who want, you know, strong, military, tough American empire are all fanatical Zionists, and that's why they want the strong American empire. But, of course, it's not just them. There are all sorts of other corrupt interests involved in looting the American people and, you know, building this gigantic military that has nothing to do with defending our borders, which is the only reason we should have a military. It has everything to do with going out and attacking and robbing people around the world, and especially protecting these crazed Zionists who are occupying Palestine.
Well, you're familiar with the Project for a New American Century, that document,
hey,
correct?
Somebody just step on the cord?
Oh, no.
Hello.
Hello?
Okay, there you are. You're coming back. You just faded out.
Okay. You're familiar with the Project for a New American Century document, correct?
Yes.
And a lot of those were probably tied in with some of this Zionist or neo. Do you want to say neoconservatives? I don't know how you would describe those particular people.
Well, it's
people.
The same thing.
Okay.
Yeah, the neoconservatives are pretty much all ardent Zionists. They're 80% plus Jewish, you know, the major neoconservative figures. And they have very strong emotional attachments to Israel. And then they also have this ideology of building up the American empire and having a new American century and all of that. But at the end of the day, you have to wonder to which country do they really have their loyalty, because the actions that they're counseling are really good for Israel and terrible for the USA. The Iraq War is a prime example. You know, that was a great move for the Israelis. It took out one of their biggest enemies and basically destroyed Iraq as a major power. You know, Iraq was full of very advanced, you know, scientists and technologists who were capable of building a serious military as well as a really good economy. You know, they were approaching European living standards twice, you know, once in the 80s before the Gulf War, and then again they were getting back on their feet prior to this most recent war. And if a powerful Iraq was a huge threat to Israel. So destroying Iraq and having the Mossad come in to occupy Iraq and murder hundreds of top Iraqi scientists and technicians really did help Israel's, you know, quest to dominate the Middle East.
But this tied right in with the 9/11 event, correct?
Well, sure.
Okay.
Because 9/11 convinced Americans that they were under attack from fanatical Muslims. Of course, the anthrax attacks that were part of the same event made that even more clear, that we could expect these WMD attacks from Muslims forever. And I think that really serves the Israeli interest, because they need the U.S. empire to be at war with Israel's enemies perpetually if their country is going to keep expanding. And it certainly doesn't serve our interest to be at war with the people that we need to buy our oil from.
So with 9/11, what is it about 9/11 that you feel needs to be really brought out and focused on, and that it's pertinent for today?
Well, there's so much evidence that shows that this was a false flag attack, an inside job that involved people in you know, top levels of command, Dick Cheney being the most obvious. So I think this idea, this meme, of course, needs to keep spreading. But I think we have to really emphasize the upside to a post 9/11 truth world, because we could get our country back, we could get our democracy back, we could reestablish the American Republic. The shock effect of 9/11 truth, if it's fully admitted by the mainstream, will allow us to push through all kinds of changes that we could only really dream about otherwise, such as taking our military down to a level where it's a genuinely defensive force, which would mean reducing the military budget by at least 80%, think of all the money that would be available for doing useful things, such as saving our economy. We could reestablish good relations with the rest of the world, including the Arab and Muslim world. We could give a profound apology to the Arab and Muslim world, pay serious reparations, force Israel to abide by the UN resolution saying back to 67 borders, and allow return of the refugees. We could basically set up a peaceful and prosperous world and return to having a peaceful, prosperous, and free country if we can stomach the truth about 9/11.
And what do you think the UN's involvement is in any of these events, or do you?
Well, I don't think the UN per se is planning any of this stuff, but I think that the corrupt New World Order forces, who are basically financiers based in London, New York, and Tel Aviv, are orchestrating an attempt to create a one-world government. And we need to oppose this. I think these are the people who were heavily involved in 9/11. These would be the Rockefeller, Rothschild financial interests, the Bilderberger group, the Trilateral Commission, Council on Foreign Relations, this sort of self-appointed elite. And those people do want to create a one-world government, and they want to use the UN as their puppet. I would rather see an honest UN where people from all countries met on terms of equality, and where people could, you know, hash things out honestly as free, sovereign, and independent nations.
And so with all the...
Hello?
You can't hear us again?
Oh, now I can hear you again.
Okay.
I don't know what's going on.
Yeah, I'm wondering if it's more on your phone there or something.
It could be.
Yeah. And so as far as, I mean, you have, like I said, there's a lot of guests I've never even heard of that you've had that, I mean, it sounds kind of fascinating. And I was going back trying to find, what are your websites, by the way, that you have so that the audience can go look further into your interests?
Well, they're all sort of nested around truthjihad.com.
Okay.
That's truthjihad.com. And from there you can get to my blog, my radio schedule, the Muslims for 9/11 Truth site, which pretty much just clips media stories involving Muslims for Truth one way or another.
And you also have the No Lies News on the Pacifica Radio?
That's right, yeah. I think I'm maybe the only radio host in the country with a show on Pacifica and also on a Patriot Network.
And that's noliesradio.org.
That's right.
Okay. And are you still involved with the website of mujca.com?
I'm not personally involved, but I support them, and they're doing great work under the steady hand of Lou Stolzenberg, who took it over 2 years ago from me and has been doing a really good job. She was behind putting together this Religious Leaders for 9/11 Truth, which is the latest of the many professional groups of, you know, pilots and architects and engineers and professors and lawyers and firefighters and so on.
And that has been being aired several times on the PBS channels, the Rocky Mountain PBS, and also our other PBS.com here in Colorado Springs.
That was wonderful. Yeah, I think everybody needs to give a huge thank you to those people at the PBS station in Denver who had the guts to play 9/11 Press for Truth. That was, in fact, they also played the Architects and Engineers video, Blueprint for Truth, I understand,
yes.
Which is great. Yeah, I wish our PBS people here in Wisconsin had that kind of guts.
You know, I'm noticing something here, too, because with your some of the people that you've had on your program, a lot of them don't seem to endorse Judy Wood, but you did an interview with Judy Wood.
I didn't endorse her.
Well, okay. All right. That's what I'm asking, because I see that you did interview her. And
yeah.
So you are of the camp, then, that thinks, I mean, because I've seen a numerous different people within the 9/11 group that have different ideas on what brought the buildings down. Not to me that, I mean, it's important, but it's also, there's some other aspects to focus on as to me is as important as that event. But, you know, to each their own, I guess, in this respect. What do you think?
Well, I think spending too much time worrying about all the arcane logistical details of what happened to the towers or what happened at the Pentagon, it has its place, but it's not. It shouldn't be front and center. You know, our real job is to take all of this evidence that we have that does show that it was a false flag inside job, and make that case to the people who haven't figured it out yet. And getting too bogged down in technical details or worrying about, you know, whether it was nanothermite or space beams or whatever, I think that gets to be a real distraction. And I do think that a lot of these issues tend to resolve themselves over time. Like, for a while, it wasn't really clear whether this thermite hypothesis that Steve Jones was following was going to make any sense. Because if you don't, you know, if you don't have nanothermite, if you don't have a kind of a thermite that can actually explode with power, you know, really powerful explosive, then it wouldn't really make sense that that was the only thing used. But over time, we found this very, very strong convincing evidence for nanothermite, like unexploded chips in the dust, all kinds of iron-rich microspheres. So we know that a lot of nanothermite was used. And you know, likewise, other questions do resolve themselves. But I think we need to, you know, keep our eyes on the prize, which is convincing the people who aren't yet on board.
So it's the convincing and not so much holding the people accountable, or all the above?
Oh, all of the above. I mean, that's part of the same process. And, you know, nyccan.org is doing a wonderful job in New York pushing this ballot initiative, which is aimed at holding the perps accountable. It's going to be a real investigation with subpoena power if it gets through. I didn't hear what happened today. They had a court hearing on it, and I haven't yet heard whether they succeeded or not. But they're kind of on the verge of getting this ballot initiative on the ballot. And then if the voters approve it, which they very well might, in fact, the polls show they will, we would have a real 9/11 investigation with subpoena power. So people really need to get on board with this and help them out. Go to nyccan.org, follow what they're doing, and give them some financial help, which they need for lawyers. They need lawyers, guns, and money, because they're in a fight of their lives in New York City right now.
Well, I sure hope that they don't bring in the same groups that were involved with the other ones. I mean, and then when you had, like, Kissinger stepping forward and I mean, it was almost like he was somebody that they knee-jerked away for, and then they went into this the next person that headed it, and I'm not sure that person was any better.
No, he was worse. That was the joke. Was they? You know, well, who's the second worst person that we could possibly pick to head up the 9/11 investigation? Henry Kissinger. And everybody starts laughing. Are you kidding? Henry Kissinger? Get out of here! So they had to, you know, yank him aside. And then they say, okay, well, the ultimate worst possible person is Philip Zelikow. Everybody says, huh? Philip who? And that's how he got away with it, because Philip Zelikow was the guy who in 1998 co-authored an article in Foreign Affairs discussing the psychological and cultural and political consequences of a massive Pearl Harbor-style terrorist event in the USA, such as, get this, the destruction of the World Trade Center. So here's a guy who knew what was going to happen 2 years in advance and was planning what it was going to be like afterwards. He's a specialist in what he calls the construction and maintenance of public myths, which he defines as these shared beliefs that may not really be true, but people believe anyway, and this creates a basis for social cohesion, such as the belief that evil Muslims did 9/11, or that Pearl Harbor was a dastardly Japanese surprise attack. So this is the guy that they picked to run the investigation. He's probably the guy who actually wrote most of the script for 9/11 itself.
Well, I kind of like Jamie Gorelick had been involved in two or three of the investigations, and it almost makes you wonder if she's like kind of a professional gatekeeper.
Well, she works for one of the big corrupt law firms in Washington, D.C., or at least she did when she was around working on the commission. So, yeah, if you actually look at this list of people who were on the 9/11 commission, you couldn't find a more pathetic and corrupt list of people if you tried. You know, these Richard Benveniste, for example, was Barry Seal's lawyer. Barry Seal was the CIA drug smuggler, and Benveniste was his lawyer and controller. And then when Barry Seal started to squeal on Benveniste, the next thing you know, Barry Seal got gunned down at a red light in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. So, I mean, how much worse, you know, of a recommendation can you get than that? I mean, this guy is you know, the drug lawyer who has his clients rubbed out when they turn on him.
And then they only showed X amount of information to a few people on this panel rather than letting them all see it.
Oh, yeah, they hid most of what they were doing, which wasn't much because they were so underfunded. You know, they were funded a small fraction of the funds that went to investigating Clinton's sexual activities. And what little they did was all pretty much under the control of Philip Zelikow, the guy who presumably he looks like he would have been exactly the kind of person who would have written the script for the 9/11 false flag attack. You know, the specialist in public myths who knew what was coming 2 years in advance and thought was thinking all about, you know, how that would manipulate public opinion. So, you know, Zelikow completely controlled the investigation. He decided what they would look into, what they wouldn't look into, who they would call, who they wouldn't call. You know, he was totally in charge. I mean, this is the guy who really needs to be called to account, I think, right up there with Dick Cheney and maybe Larry Silverstein. But I think, you know, Zelikow and Cheney, you know, look like sort of the mastermind and the point man. And I guess Wolfowitz and Pearl would be major people of interest, too.
So as far as with the work that you're doing, what is your main goal and what direction are you trying to get across to your public?
Well, I kind of have different publics. You know, let's just simplify and say I have two publics. You know,
okay.
One public is the people who listen regularly to my radio show who are aware of a lot of these things. And so I invite people on the radio to talk about stuff that such folks will find interesting and, you know, maybe get some new information from. And I'm pretty outspoken in dealing with that public. I'll come out and say exactly what I think and without any fear of the consequences. The other public is the general public, the people who haven't really figured this out yet. And those are really the people that we need to reach. So for those people, what I do is I try to give effective mainstream interviews and I think I succeed as often as I fail, which is, you know, I'm not doing too badly at that. And then secondly, I do things like run for Congress, which attracts the attention of the general public to these issues. And then this latest book I wrote, Questioning the War on Terror, A Primer for Obama Voters, as I said, is designed to give to ordinary Obama voters. And it's very carefully designed and test marketed to take your average Obama voter and turn them into a 9/11 truther pretty quickly. And I'm selling a lot of these in packages of 10 for only $50, which is this crazy $5 a piece price, to people who are hip to 9/11 truth who need something to give to their less aware friends. And that's been the main sales engine. That's the main reason we've almost sold out the whole first edition in less than 3 months.
Wow.
Do you plan to run for office again?
I'm thinking about it. My wife found the stresses of the last run for office were a little much for her, so she's a partner in the decision this time around. But there's a chance I will. I think it's a good way. I think everybody should. You guys should run for office, too, because it gives you a real entry into the mainstream media, and you can take these important issues that they're blacking out and force them to at least acknowledge that they exist.
You know, looking at, again, of all the guests that you feel that you have probably gained the most insight and info, what might be a couple of them that you and have added to your public's knowledge? Anybody in particular?
You know, there have been so many amazing guests. It's really hard to pin down a couple, but, you know, I guess a couple of really important ones would be James Douglas. It's spelled like Douglas, except with two S's on the end. He's a kind of a peace Catholic guy who wrote this recent book on the JFK assassination. I think it's called JFK and the Unspeakable, and it recently shot up to near the top of the bestseller list when Oliver Stone plugged it. James Douglas's book JFK and the Unspeakable is, I think, really the first book that everybody who hasn't studied the JFK assassination needs to read. In fact, you could get by with just reading that book and you'll understand really what's important about that event. Another incredible guest was William Pepper. William Pepper is the legal force or I think the biggest legal force behind the 9/11 ballot initiative in New York. He's also a major legal force behind the Spanish court, which is trying to prosecute Bush and Cheney for war crimes. And he wrote a book on the Martin Luther King Jr. assassination about his experience as the King family lawyer who proved to a civil jury that Dr. Martin Luther King was killed by a conspiracy involving the CIA, the FBI, the U.S. military, and elements of organized crime. And he got people like the colonel who organized the team of Army snipers who were on the rooftop backing up the Martin Luther King assassination. This colonel actually talked to him and explained why he did it. He said, yeah, we had to kill Martin Luther King because these rioters in 68 were all, you know, jazzed up on Martin Luther King, and Martin Luther King was going to bring a million people to Washington, D.C., and we were afraid it was going to be a revolution. So he actually got confessions from these top people, including like a colonel in the military who was directly involved in moving soldiers onto the roof of a building next to where King was shot. So William Pepper, who broke that case, his book is called Act of State, and you can get there through actofstate.org, is another of my all-time favorite guests. And a third would be Richard, let me say this real quick, Richard Falk, F-A-L-K, who's become a real powerful voice for the plight of the Palestinians. He's an international law professor at Princeton. He's of Jewish background, and he's one of the heroic people of Jewish background who are standing up and telling the truth about both 9/11 and Israel-Palestine.
He's not one that's affiliated with the Council on Foreign Relations, is he?
Oh, yeah, he actually is. But
okay.
See, the Council on Foreign Relations, what they are is they're the club of anybody who wants to have any say in foreign policy. And just because somebody's a member of it doesn't necessarily mean they're a bad person. They could be a good person, like Richard Falk, who honestly believes that some kind of democratic and transparent world governance from below would be a good way to go. And I think idealistic people often think that. And that's a very different perspective on global governance from this New World Order elite that is trying to do it from the top down through mass murder.
And you don't think that the Council on Foreign Relations is heavily involved in that New World Order group?
Oh, sure they are. They're a puppet of it, just like the UN is. But just like not every delegate at the UN or not every UN official is a criminal culprit who's trying to use the UN to create the New World Order, not every member of the Council on Foreign Relations is guilty of these things either. And I don't think Richard Falk is. I think he's an honest, idealistic guy who happens to believe that world government, a democratic world government, not a Rockefeller-Rothschild world government, would be a good thing for the planet. And he's entitled to that belief. And even those of us who are skeptical about world government in general should admit that somebody like Richard could be a good guy and still be wrong on this issue, but it doesn't mean he's not a good guy.
Well, I'm not really saying that either, other than the fact that I'm just... It's kind of like, you know, only it takes a few to control the many, and it depends upon their intent, correct?
Well, sure, yeah. But I think what the people we have to worry about are much more Machiavellian. You know, the idealistic world government people like Richard Falk can be made into the tools of these Machiavellian, you know, evil people behind the New World Order. So you know, we have to keep all that in mind. But again, I think it's really important to realize that there can be people who don't share our approach to various issues that we feel strongly about, who can be very good people who have something interesting and important to tell us, and we should try to listen with an open mind. You know, too often we get into this sort of factional good guy bad guy thing,
mm-hmm.
Like, oh, Richard Falk, he's on the Council of Foreign Relations, must be a bad guy. If you actually look at what he does and what he says, he's not a bad guy.
Okay, there's one that you had on here that's Adrian Salbucci. What did you think of that and what his message was?
Oh, he's great. I love him. He's going to be on my show Saturday on American Freedom Radio. And, yeah, he's an Argentine, what would you call him, an anti-globalist economist. And he tells the truth very flat out about Israel-Palestine. He tells the truth about 9/11, and I think his vision of what's going on in the world is quite accurate.
I also kind of liked what he had to say about what's going on with the Argentinians and their economy, correct? I mean, that and how that might be pertinent to what's going on with ours.
Indeed, yeah. I think he's talked about the takedown of the Argentine economy. They collapsed it a while back, and after that collapse was horrendous. You know, people were... left without power, without water, you know, without food in the stores, you know. And that's the kind of thing that a lot of people say we need to be concerned about here, that it looks like they might be collapsing our economy, too. We could end up in that situation, and, you know, you might want to stockpile some dry food and some candles and, you know, think about what you'll do if that happens.
But didn't Argentina actually go through it more than once?
They may have. I mean, I know there's sort of one. When was that big collapse? You know, I'm forgetting what year it was, but at some point the global finance elite,
somewhere around 2000 maybe,
yeah,
was one, and then maybe 20 or 30 years ago another one.
I was thinking of the more recent one.
Uh huh. And then another one that really looked interesting that I'd never been familiar with was Dorian Sagan.
Oh, he's wonderful. Yeah, he's a really good writer. He's the son of Lynn Margulis and her then husband Carl Sagan, and both Lynn and Carl are, you know, two of the most interesting scientific figures you'll ever meet. Lynn is probably a far more important scientist than Carl ever was, although she's not as well known. She's a big 9/11 truth supporter, and she and Dorian write these great books together and separately. So yeah, Dorian's a lot of fun. Now, I had him on after Harun Yahya, who is probably the world's leading anti-evolutionist. He's a Muslim, and so he has a huge audience, especially in the Muslim countries. And so he spent an hour, you know, preaching against Darwinism. And then we brought on Dorian Sagan, who, of course, is not of that same mindset. So it was a really interesting meeting of the minds.
And you like to get kind of into some of these different interviews where you have differing opinions, correct?
Yeah, I think it's more interesting that way. You know, I studied script writing for films at one point, and I remember the teacher said that, never forget, drama is conflict. So it's tricky. You know, how do we productively use conflict? Because conflict can be unproductive, too. You know, people getting an email, flame wars to no end. But using conflict to create audience interest, to get people motivated and tuned in and you know, revved up a little bit, I think is a great way to go. And it's really fun, you know. People saw me fighting with Hannity on Fox News, and that's what they thought of me. I said, oh, this is a guy who fought back against Hannity. And so I've just kind of continued on that path and been willing to get some conflict going in various ways on my radio shows.
You got to be good and on your toes when you do that sort of thing.
Yeah, so sometimes it's tough. I recently had on Steve Alton, and he's a wonderful guy. He's the author of A Shell Game, a great 9/11 truth novel, and it just came out in paperback, a whole new edition. He's a very strong 9/11 truth supporter. He's also an American Jew who hasn't really thought his way out of the Zionist box, is the way I would describe it. You know, he's kind of shares the mindset of kind of moderate pro-Israel people. And so when he saw me, you know, interviewing Bolin and giving this talk and saying, this is how Muslims see it, you know, and then explaining that Muslims, you know, see it as you know, it's the Zionism, stupid. Steve didn't like that at all. And so I had him on my show, and he spent kind of an hour yelling at me. And I mean,
it really takes a lot of work trying to, I mean, with all the variety that you have on the people that you do invite on, and you know, being prepared to do an interview and be able to talk intelligently with the people, you got a lot of homework here.
Well, there's a certain amount of jujitsu involved, where they come at you with their thing, and you sort of move out of the way in a certain way, and then they kind of keep on moving, and, you know, you don't necessarily have to do a full 50% of the work.
Of the many theories out there on 9/11, which ones do you most support?
You mean the evidence about
yeah.
how it was done and so on? Well, personally, I've always thought that Steve Jones was doing good work, and, you know, I always disagreed with Jim Fetzer at the same time I was, you know, on the same radio show with him. I did Monday, Friday, he did Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, but, you know, I always thought that Steve was doing good work, and I think he's been borne out. I mean, unless there's some kind of really unimaginable fraud going on, they've proved that this nanothermite, highly advanced explosive was a major factor, and perhaps the main or only factor, in taking down these three skyscrapers on 9/11. So, I mean, this research has really been borne out, I think. As for another question, I think got settled on my radio show today. I brought on a guy from Pilots. I was going to have on Rob Balsamo. I've had him on before, and there's been this dispute about whether these alleged airspeeds of these aircraft that hit the World Trade Center were possible. That one was clocked at 510 miles an hour, and the other was, what was it, 430 or 40 or something. And that has been a raging question for quite some time, and I think it's been settled now. These airspeeds would not be possible for commercial 767 aircraft, and therefore either all of the data pointing at these airspeeds is wrong, and it's hard to tell how it would be, or the aircraft that hit the World Trade Center were not commercial 767s, and therefore it was not these flights we were told that it was. So I think that's pretty important.
So if it was a different plane, you're saying that they could get these speeds where that particular type of plane wouldn't?
Sure, sure. Okay. I mean, there are presumably planes and missiles and, you know, there are things that can fly at 500 miles an hour plus, or 510 knots, rather, at sea level. But commercial 767s are not one of those things. It's pretty clear that a commercial 767 would almost certainly fall apart if it were going that speed at sea level, number one. Number two, it couldn't get to that speed at sea level. There's no way the engines could get it going that fast. And number three, if somehow it could, it would be difficult or impossible for even the world's most experienced pilot to control. And therefore, if you were loading the World Trade Center with nanothermite and you needed a plane crash as the excuse for taking it down, you would not use one of these commercial aircraft at these speeds because the odds of hitting the target would be virtually zero. So I think we know now that almost certainly these were not commercial aircraft, and that's really important. We also know that the government story of the Pentagon is completely false as well, and that the flight path they told us about couldn't possibly have been a real flight path for a commercial airplane. We know that there's been no evidence whatsoever that these 19 guys that they blamed for hijacking the planes were even on any of the attack planes. And that absence of evidence is evidence of absence because they would have provided the proof in the form of videos, surveillance videos, testimony from airline employees, ticket stubs, official passenger lists from the airlines. None of that was ever produced, and therefore we can be certain that none of these guys were actually on these planes.
Or even how one passport survived this fire.
Right. Yeah, that's another example of this ridiculously overplanted evidence. The miraculous passport that floated down from the towering inferno of the Trade Center to be discovered as evidence. And there's also a magical bandana, a magical hijacker's bandana that was like the only thing that they found at the empty hole in the ground in Pennsylvania where they claimed the plane had just gone into the hole and disappeared into the ground, leaving a bandana and nothing else.
Would you tell us a bit about the TV reporting and how that figured into propaganda in regard to what was happening at the World Trade Center?
Sure. They really jumped the gun. You know, for example, of course, you know, everybody knows, at least everybody in 9/11 Truth knows, that the BBC reported that Building 7 had collapsed 20 minutes before it actually did collapse. Now, that was really jumping the gun. And likewise, they jumped the gun by saying Bin Laden did it just almost the instant it happened. Must have been Bin Laden, planting that idea in people's minds. So even when Bin Laden then subsequently repeatedly denied any connection with 9/11, he deplored the attacks as a terrible un-Islamic crime, the murder of civilians, innocent people. He really made it very clear that not only did he have nothing to do with it, but that he deplored this horrible crime. But none of that stuck in people's minds because on 9/11 itself, when people had been shocked into a state of hypnotic susceptibility, these newscasters just kept saying, Bin Laden, Bin Laden, Bin Laden. And then by the next day, they gave us the list of the 19 guys they said had done it. And they claimed that came from Mohammed Atta's magic suitcase that I mentioned earlier. So they were, you know, the media was on board with this from the get-go. People in the media clearly were working for the bad guys. There are probably lots of intelligence assets at the top of the media. William Colby, the former CIA director, once bragged that he owned the most influential journalists in the media. And I think some of those people were the people who were chanting Bin Laden, Bin Laden, Bin Laden on 9/11.
Well, I find it very interesting that on the day of the attack, many reporters talked about this looking like a demolition. And then after the first day, it was never mentioned again, even though Building 7 had no airplane fly into it and just fell down.
That's right. Dan Rather famously said, it looked just like one of those controlled demolitions we're all familiar with from seeing those Las Vegas hotels come down. And then he wouldn't talk about it after that. I tried to bring this up with him when he was at the Media Reform Conference in Minneapolis last year. And these people that looked like Secret Service bodyguards instantly, like, closed ranks between me and him and hustled him out of there. And, and a panic-stricken look came over his face when I brought that up. You know, I started to say, Dan, do you still hold with your original opinion that World Trade Center was a controlled demolition? And by the time I was done with the sentence, he was like 50 feet away with the Secret Service. I mean, they practically picked him up under the armpits and hauled him out of there at a sprint, like the Secret Service guys did with Cheney on 9/11 in the White House.
Was it you that confronted Amy Goodman?
Yeah, I did. She spoke at the University of Wisconsin a couple of years ago, and so during the question-answer period, I asked her, you know, why, given the fact that she was there at the demolition of Building 7, and there are YouTube videos showing this, that she has never reported on it. And her answer was, first she cracked this little joke of, I didn't demolish Building 7. And then she said, I do support a new 9/11 investigation. Well, that's all well and good, but now that there is a push in New York for a new 9/11 investigation through nyccan.org, she isn't reporting on it. Her coverage of 9/11 overall has been utterly atrocious. She accepted over $100,000 from the Ford Foundation, which is a CIA front, to report on 9/11 right after the attacks. And, of course, what that six-figure sum of money really was for was to shut up about 9/11, to not tell the truth about it, to support the big lie. And that's what she's been doing ever since.
Do you find a lot of that in the media, of people that have been that appear to have been hushed up or bought off?
Well, as far as bought off, it's hard to really prove when people are bought off. But in a sense, almost everybody in the mainstream media is bought off, because everybody knows that trying to tell the truth about 9/11 in the mainstream media is a sure ticket to career suicide. So they've managed to really buy everybody off just by creating this whole zeitgeist of fear, and, you know, by slandering truth seekers as so-called conspiracy theorists. They've kind of bought off the whole country.
So of all the things in the eight years, since 9/11, have we accomplished anything? Do you think we're going to get anywhere with this that has a positive outcome out of it?
Well, yeah, I think we've accomplished a lot. Dr. Bob Bowman, who used to run the space weapons program under Presidents Ford and Carter, and he's a rocket scientist, a PhD from Caltech, and a former fighter pilot, you know, he knows his stuff. He said that he thinks the 9/11 truth movement is what has stopped them from doing it again. That is, if we hadn't been there, there would have already been at least one similar event. So that's quite an accomplishment in itself. And I think we've changed public opinion in a very deep way. People just are deep down really suspicious of the powers that be right now in so many ways, as they well should be. And I think the 9/11 truth movement, even though on the surface it's ignored and ridiculed by the mainstream, has been a huge factor in this changing the climate of opinion to one in which, you know, mistrust of the powers that be is probably greater now than it ever has been in history. And I think that's healthy.
And long overdue.
Indeed. And we still have a chance of getting justice. You know, it might take 20 years. It might take 15 years. You can't expect instant results for something like this. It's a really carefully planned out and massive covert operation, and it's not the kind of thing that one person can stand up and speak the truth and change the world instantly. but we still can do it, and it could happen anytime. The New York City Ballot Initiative at nyccan.org really does have a chance. I don't know what the court case results were today, but those people are going to keep at it until they get that that investigation in New York that they're seeking. And that's just one avenue. There are all sorts of other avenues where the truth and could come out and justice could prevail.
You know, I really have to thank you for coming back on and spending yeah. this time with us. I'm sorry that our that Dr. Carlstrom was not feeling well, that and so I would have liked to have had him join us, but you know, we did. I'm glad that Katie was able to stand in, and I hope we're able to bring out some information for the public on with your background, Kevin. And
thanks, Melody, and thanks, Katie. It's been fun chatting with you, and maybe I'll have to have you on my show sometime.
Okay.
And once again, your two books are Questioning the War on Terrorism, and your other one is Truth Jihad, My Epic Struggle Against the 9/11 Big Lie.
Indeed.
And they can find all that information at truthjihad.com.
You got it.
All right. Thank you so much.
Okay. Well, thank both of you, and have a good night, and hope to talk to you again sometime.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Okay.
Good
Bye-bye.
Night.
Good night.